From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Nigerian writer Wole Soyinka, the first African to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. Soyinka also writes about the politics of his country, or what he describes as Nigeria's tragic soap opera. He's now in America, warning that the future of democracy in Nigeria is in jeopardy. We'll talk about the crisis in Nigeria, about Soyinka's 2 years in solitary confinement for criticizing his government, and about his childhood in a Yoruba village. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Fugitive, the film version of the popular 1960s TV series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House is debating the compromise deficit reduction package that Democrats say will cut the deficit by nearly $500 billion. A vote on the plan is expected later this evening. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
It's been a day of impassioned debate on the floor and of wheeling and dealing behind the scenes as Democratic leaders pushed for support of the package. Republicans have blasted the plan as taxing too many too much. Democrats have countered that Republicans have not been telling the whole story. Democrat Walter Tucker of California.
This is a war of truth, Mr. Speaker, and the truth is that this tax bill will hurt the top 1%, the top 1% of the people in this country.
Late today, House leaders announced they had agreed to take up in the fall measures to lock in additional spending cuts, hoping to win the support of wavering conservative members. The deficit reduction package is expected to win narrow approval later this evening. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
The State Department's top expert on Bosnia resigned today in a protest over the Clinton administration's policy on the civil war in the former Yugoslav Republic. Marshal Freeman Harris told reporters that there's widespread opposition in the State Department to the international plan to divide Bosnia into three ethnic states. The Clinton administration supports the plan, although it's taken a tougher line against the Bosnian Serbs than most European allies. Harris said he believes that the United States should not accept the forcible dismemberment of a sovereign UN nation. The United States has sent more planes to Italian military bases in case they're needed for a multilateral airstrike in Bosnia. NATO military authorities continue to work on plans for a possible strike. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
The Pentagon says before any expanded military action occurs in Bosnia, and there's no certainty it will, detailed plans must be presented to the North Atlantic Council, NATO's governing body. The Pentagon spokesman, Navy Captain Michael Doubleday, says the plans are almost complete.
My understanding is that they anticipate still sometime late this week providing plans to NATO headquarters.
Captain Doubleday also says forward air controllers, or FACs, are now getting into position on the ground in Bosnia. The FACs work with ground troops to help coordinate strikes. Some 60 attack aircraft are now in place in Italy and aboard aircraft carriers around Bosnia. Secretary of State Warren Christopher will be visiting the Aviano Air Base in Italy tomorrow to review military planning. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street. Among the biggest losers were mining issues, which plunged along with gold and silver prices. The Dow lost 3 points to close at 3,549. This is NPR. Independent counsel Lawrence Walsh completed his 6.5-year investigation of the Iran-Contra affair today by filing a report with the special court that appointed him. The probe cost almost $36 million and resulted in 11 convictions. But the key convictions of former National Security Advisor John Poindexter and former White House aide Oliver North were overturned on appeal. President Bush pardoned former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger and former CIA official Dwayne Claridge and 4 other officials. The court may make the report public, but is not required to do so. In New York City, defense attorneys for the suspects in the Landmarks bombing plot accused the government of leaking tapes to the media. NPR's Maria Hinojosa reports.
Attorney William Kunstler, who represents one of the 11 defendants in the plot to bomb the United Nations, said in court today that the government had leaked parts of tapes that were made by a secret government informant in the bomb plot. The transcripts of conversations between an FBI informer and his alleged co-conspirators were first heard on ABC News earlier this week. Attorney Kunstler said the government purposefully leaked selective parts of the tapes that could implicate his clients. Kunstler's legal partner is Ron Kuby.
The government, by their own misconduct, was able to profit from their own misconduct. Last week they came in, they asked for a non-disclosure order, the judge refused to give it. So they leaked a bunch of derogatory transcripts, and then they come in and ask for a non-disclosure order, and they receive it.
Kuby says the non-disclosure order, which is just short of a gag rule, will handicap the defense, but none of the defense attorneys believe the leaks would stop anytime soon. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
The FBI says the man who opened fire today at the federal courthouse in Topeka, Kansas, apparently killed himself. The man, identified as Jack Gary McKnight, was to have been sentenced today. An FBI spokesman said the suspect killed a security guard and wounded three other people. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wally Schoyenko was the first African to receive the Nobel Prize for Literature. That was in 1986. The African-American writer and professor Henry Louis Gates said it was a miracle that Schoyenko was alive to get this prize. Schoyenko is an outspoken critic of military rule in his country, Nigeria, and has been imprisoned for his views. This week, Schoyenko is in the U.S., warning that the future of democracy in Nigeria is in jeopardy. In June, the first elections in 10 years were held, but the elections were annulled by President Babangida, the general who took over in a 1985 military coup. The general has promised that new elections will be held, and Nigeria will return to civilian rule by August 27th. He first promised a swift return to civilian rule back in 1986. There have been violent protests against the government's decision to void the election. I asked Schoyenko what it feels like to have an election annulled.
Well, it's a very weird feeling of complete unreality. It's as if there has been a game. Both sides have played the best they can. One side wins, of course. The other loses. At the end of the match, they shake hands. Then the referee comes along and says, no, that match is null and void because the goalposts should not have been where they were to start with. It's the most bizarre kind of experience. Now, if the annulment had come about as a result of protestations, and this has happened before local government or something like that, proven malfeasance and so on, there would have been no problem. But this was an election which was declared by international monitors, by civil rights organizations who were monitoring the elections, by even government parastatals, which was set up for this kind of purpose. The Center for Democratic Studies, another organization called MAMSA, all of them gave exemplary pass marks to the election. And then along comes the referee and says, no, the elections did not take place.
Yeah, the president has said he'll hand over power to civilian rule on August 27th. Do you think that's going to happen?
The president has said so many things. He's sworn so many things, crossed my heart, and so on and so forth. He's sworn things on his honor and he's gone back on his word. Nobody trusts the word of President Babangida anymore.
What are your fears of what might happen in the near future in your country?
Well, to use your favorite expression here, there is a worst-case scenario and there is a more acceptable, agonizing scenario. All I know, what I believe, is that Babangida will leave that office. He will leave that office willingly or unwillingly. The mood of the nation is such that the nation will not tolerate the prolongation of military rule. People want the military out of their lives, permanently, out of their political lives, that is. Now, looking at the irreconcilability of the positions, There is a possibility of some kind of civil war at a certain level. Now, that's the worst possible scenario. I believe that this will not come about. What may come about is that we will have, in effect, a Zairean scenario whereby you have two governments in that country, and then people, both inside and international communities outside, will have to choose which one they recognize as the legitimate government of the people of Nigeria.
You've used the expression the humiliation of tyranny. Let me ask you to expand on that.
Yes, well, here is one typical example. Humiliation comes about as a result of impotence. You know, a situation which is pernicious, which is wrong, which is exploitative, and you're left with a feeling of impotence. Nothing you can do about it, at least nothing that will not cost the victims far more than it will cost the aggressors. In other words, the equation is totally unbalanced. Now, in this particular instance, here is a very tiny cabal. And when I say a tiny cabal, I mean really tiny. It's even a minority part of the military, but one which controls certain forces. And it is ramming its will down the throats of the Nigerian peoples. You have a tyranny which has set rules for an election, rules and procedures which were grudgingly, very grudgingly accepted by the populace simply because they felt, well, this may be the last sacrifice to get these unwanted supervisors of their lives out of the way. And then the rules are changed and changed again. Politicians or contestants who once were banned, detained, are undetained and then let loose to contest, after which they are banned again. New rules are made in the middle of the game, such as, for instance, one of the latest, in order to get rid of two unwanted candidates, suddenly new rules were made which made it impossible for any contestant to be accepted if he's under 50 years of age. Now, what could be more ridiculous, more insulting than that to a people's intelligence? The president of this country is under 50, to the best of my knowledge, and what has age got to do with it on that level anyway? The other one is disqualified on the grounds that he was not up to a year in the party. Nobody can contest for this position if he's less than 1 year old in the party. And this power base forgets, in fact, that the electoral lists had been totally cancelled and renewed so that nobody in the party is 1 year old legally. Now, it is stupidities like that, irrationalities, very tortuous and odious manipulation of peoples, which are presented to a very intelligent and sophisticated public as something desirable on behalf of a democratic structure. Now, that all this constitute the kind of humiliation which is experienced today by the average Nigerian.
Your country, Nigeria, gained its independence from England in 1960. What were your ideals then?
You ask a very chastening question there. It was one of very high optimism. I was a student in England just on the eve of independence, and I could not wait to get back and contribute to making a showcase, if you like, of Nigeria on the African continent. Of course, I was not unaware of the difficulties. I was not unaware of the fact that the first generation post-colonial politicians who held the reins of power had certain notions which were not compatible with the, shall we say, the highest ideals of nation builders. Many of them clearly felt that they were there just to step into the shoes of the departing colonial masters, with all the privileges, with all the power sense, the dominating kind of attitude. We were aware of that, but we were convinced, my generation at least, were convinced that we had enough will, enough capability, enough understanding of the situation to really transform that nation in a very short while.
Was it surprising to you that Nigerians could be corrupt and power-hungry oppressors of their own people?
Well, the issue of corruption is not one which I find myself unduly obsessed with, because I find corruption everywhere, as corruption in the Soviet Union. If we look at Italy today, it looks as if that is one showcase of corruption for the whole world. American society also has its corrupt practices and so on. But the problem with Nigeria's own brand of corruption is that it does not produce. In other words, corruption appears to be the industry rather than it's been an unfortunate and reprehensible offspin of genuine, productive efforts. And that is why I think Nigeria is very backward today.
Do you blame the problems that Nigeria and some other African countries have been having on the path toward democracy? Do you blame that on the aftermath of colonialism or just on the more rotten part of human nature?
A little bit of both. And also, don't let us forget that the Western world, and indeed the Eastern world, the former Eastern world, very much favored the strong man in Africa. Their idea was that since they were removing their presence, they could operate, they could relate better commercially, politically, even socially, with a strong man in charge. That's the expression, the strong man of Nicaragua, the strong man of Zaire, the strong man of Ghana. That kind of expression, which just inflated the ego of these little petty tyrants, who felt that since their very presence, their individual presence, was so much in demand, was so congenial to the wishes and the plans of their former colonial masters or their new European allies, that their path of absolute despotism was the correct one.
Wole Soyinka is my guest. He's a Nobel Prize-winning writer from Nigeria, and he's the chairman of the African Democratic League. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wole Soyinka, Nobel Prize-winning writer and chairman of the African Democratic League. Now, I believe you were studying abroad in London at about the time of Nigerian independence. You came back to Nigeria. What part did you want to play in the life of your newly independent country?
One thing which I was certain of was that I was no politician. A political activist, yes, but politician in the sense of going into politics, running for office, no, that was not my idea of contribution. I was mostly interested in collaborating with people of my temperament, whether in the sciences, the arts, and technology, in providing a pool of expertise for the various needs of the country. And of seeing that we participated in the liberation of the African continent from colonialism.
At what point did you find yourself becoming a dissident?
Almost immediately, shortly after my return. By observing the then politicians at close quarters, I found that the niggling fears which we had students when we beheld them perform during partial independence, we found that this disease was a little bit more serious than we thought. In other words, the idea that their responsibilities were limited to simply performing as replacements of colonial masters. Mind you, there were exceptions. Even within Nigeria, there were exceptions. And I considered it my duty at the time to try and ally, however indirectly, with those progressive elements within Nigeria.
What are the actions that got you into the most trouble?
Well, I'm basically a writer, as you know. That is my profession. And one feels that the dissemination of ideas, of knowledge, the contestation even of ideas, should be enough to propel a nation along progressive routes. And by that, you know, I use the word very specifically, a route which along which one serves the people rather than oneself. And, of course, as time went on, I found that writing the word was no longer enough for certain specific situations. And so during the Biafran War, for instance, I'd already tasted a little bit of prison hospitality before then, But during the Biafran War in particular, when I was convinced that we were being plunged into a war which was unjust, unnecessary, and totally avoidable, I visited, at great risk, the enclave of Biafra to meet Ojukwu, the then rebel leader, the leader of the ceded nation of Biafra. And of course, on return, I was arrested, interrogated, and ended up serving 2 years and 3-4 months in prison, most of it in solitary confinement. So I think that was a single action that created the most problem for me.
You've written that solitary confinement begets strange monsters. What monsters came to you when you were locked up by yourself?
Ooh, rather frightening ones. Hallucinations, as a result of hallucinations, a period when you were afraid that you could not be absolutely accurate about what constituted a reality. In other words, because you're alone and you cannot sort of test your ideas on other people, you cannot share certain very strange experiences you went through as a result of solitude, you began to question even what is obviously reality. Now, that was a phase which lasted a month or two, but I managed to transcend that phase and slaughter the monsters.
Were there specific things that most confused you about what was real and what was not?
Shapes, mostly. The self-transformation of shapes, shadows, especially in the evening, just as dusk fell, and the light played tricks on leaves and trees and walls, even on the grill through which the rainwater, flowed, and so on. The impact of certain experiences, like a row of chained feet dragging themselves slowly across those tiny grills, which I mentioned earlier. The impact of the silences that accompanied executions, and so on and so forth. These were the things which contributed, I think, to a temporary loss of an assured grasp on reality.
How much light was there in your cell?
Oh, during the day there was plenty of light, and during the day I was released from my cell, and I could sit in the corridor there within the compound. At night, of course, there was no light, but there was a bulb in the corridor, which I succeeded in tricking towards the grill above my door, so I could use some of the light in the evening, which was the best time to scribble with my improvised paper, pen, ink, things like that.
What did you do to improvise paper?
Toilet paper was always there, and of course the...
It's really hard to write on toilet paper because it's so thin.
The kind of toilet paper they serve you in prison,
I guess that's true.
can take any kind of a quill.
And you had a pen?
I made pen. I made
What'd you make
ink.
Them out of?
I made pens out of bones, which occasionally came with pieces of meat. I made pens even out of some bones and metals which I dug up from the earth around the cell. Once even a crow was kind enough. It was a very, very, very weird moment because the compound was open to the skies, high walls, and so on. And a quill flew over and dropped, a crow flew over and dropped a quill literally at my feet. I even wrote a poem to it. It was such a,
do you remember
such
the
a strange
poem?
Moment. I think I entitled it Crow Quill, but I cannot remember the lines.
I think you went on hunger strikes more than once while you were in prison. What did you hope to achieve by that?
Well, I was protesting. First of all, at the beginning, I went on hunger strike because I was not being brought to trial, and I wanted, as they say, my day in court. I wanted to use that opportunity to denounce what is going on. Eventually, I give that up, or was made to give it up. Then the second time, which was more serious, this was in Kaduna Prison when I was in solitary confinement. And I think I sort of came to a desperate conclusion that if I didn't do something desperate, my mind might not survive intact. That really was the motivation for the second bout of hunger strike, which really went very, very far.
So you thought the discipline of the hunger strike would help keep your mind intact?
That helped, and also I felt that if I was wasting away, the prison authorities would realize that they were confronted with a dangerous situation and would have to do something.
Did they?
Well, whether that was what worked, or it worked in combination with protestations outside and letters of inquiries from Amnesty International and human rights bodies all over the world and even some governments, I don't know. But suddenly, I was allowed to have books. A book would be brought from time to time, and when I finished with it, it would be taken away. And that was a great boost to my exercises for keeping sane. It boosted my toilet paper material because I was now able to write between the lines, and I still have those volumes with my scribbles between the lines.
So the books also became your writing tablets.
That is correct.
Yes. When you look back on what you wrote while you were in prison, how does it read to you? Does it hold up?
Yes, some of it did, and in fact, I made an astonishing discovery, which will be probably be useful for those who study the psychology of creativity. When I came out, I don't know whether that's experience of most people, most prisoners. The last thing I wanted to think about was that prison experience, and whatever happened in there. For me, it was invalid. It was 2 years and some months written off my life. I refused to accept that anybody should benefit, should be able to produce anything at all from prison. And so when I began writing Ake, The Years of Childhood, later, I did not remember that I had actually begun writing that book in prison. And it was a revelation years after the book was published to, you know, chance on those chaplets of mine, the books, and find that I had begun writing Ake in there. And that, in fact, there were huge, you know, there were chunks of paragraphs which seemed to have been, it's almost as if I'd copied them from the original draft. So that's interesting.
It really is. It really is.
I found it very curious.
The mind really plays tricks too, mm-hmm. doesn't it?
Yes, yes. And there's some other poems which I wrote in prison. For instance, I smuggled out some poems while I was in prison, and these were published while I was still in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Wole Soyinka is the winner of the 1986 Nobel Prize for Literature and the chair of the African Democratic League. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. More with Soyinka in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more with Nigerian writer Wole Soyinka, winner of the 1986 Nobel Prize for Literature. He'll tell us about the Christian and Yoruba traditions that influenced his early life. He read a lot as a boy and kept to himself. In the Yoruba tradition, that much introspection is cause for concern. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Fugitive, starring Harrison Ford as the wrongly accused man and Tommy Lee Jones as his pursuer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Well, the House nears a vote on President Clinton's budget. The White House is lobbying the Senate where it goes next. The long-awaited showdown over deficit reduction is shaping up to be a narrow vote in both the House and the Senate. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
This afternoon, the House began 6 hours of debate on the $496 billion program of tax increases and spending cuts. Meanwhile, there's new trouble in the Senate, where Nebraska lawmaker Bob Kerrey says he's now undecided about how he'll vote. The White House breathed a sigh of relief yesterday when Arizona Democrat Dennis DeConcini announced he would support the plan, offsetting a defection last week by David Boren of Oklahoma. But if Kerry votes no, even Vice President Al Gore's tie-breaking vote will not be enough to save the package. If the House passes the plan tonight, the Senate will vote on it tomorrow. Meanwhile, the Capitol switchboard has been flooded with calls prompted by President Clinton's speech and Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole's plea to the American people to tell lawmakers how they feel about the plan. In just 1 hour today, 450,000 people tried to call Congress. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
In Geneva, Bosnian peace talks have been delayed until Monday amid indications that there are difficulties in getting the Muslim-led Bosnian government back into meetings. A spokesman said that there will be no talks tomorrow as slated, and Serbian and Croatian leaders have been told to return to Geneva the first of the week. The talks have been deadlocked all week, with Bosnian government officials boycotting the meetings until Serbian forces pull their troops out of mountain areas near Sarajevo. Serbian military leaders say they will pull their troops back if UN peacekeeping forces go in. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela has issued a strong appeal for peace and political tolerance in black townships. Some 130 people have been killed in violence this week. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
Mandela addressed a crowd of several thousand supporters in Katlehong, a township southeast of Johannesburg that has been among the hardest hit in this week's spasm of violence. While blaming police and residents of migrant workers' hostels for most of the fighting, Mandela acknowledged that some of his own supporters were active participants. He advised them to get out of the ANC.
If you are going to kill innocent people, children, elderly people, women, then you don't belong to the African National Congress.
Mandela asked the crowd to make friends with members of the ANC's bitter rival, the Inkatha Freedom Party. He said Inkatha leader Mangosuthu Buthelezi would soon tour the troubled townships with him to appeal for peace. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 3 points to close at 3,548.97 on volume of 250 million shares. This is NPR News. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says that he will fly to Syria again tomorrow, and after two meetings with Israeli Prime Minister Rabin, he called the peace process back on track. Christopher told reporters today that he is acting as a go-between between Rabin and Syrian leader Assad. One official said that the Middle Eastern peace talks now underway are more involved with process than difficult issues. Christopher also plans to stop at a U.S. Air Force base in Italy for a briefing on military preparations for possible air attacks in Bosnia if there are airstrikes against Bosnian Serbs. That would be conducted in part by airplanes at the base. In Prairie du Rocher, Illinois, the fight against the Mississippi River continues. The water is receding, but the town is still in danger. Mark Minnelli of member station KWMU reports from St. Louis.
Volunteers continue to pile sandbags atop two levees protecting Prairie du Rocher, about 50 miles south of St. Louis. On Wednesday, workers used dynamite to blast more holes in a levee on the Mississippi, hoping to relieve pressure on the town. The strategy seems to be working, but volunteers remain busy shoring up several spots which have shown signs of erosion. Officials with the Army Corps of Engineers say they're cautiously optimistic the levees will continue to hold. Meanwhile, across the Mississippi in St. Genevieve, Missouri, residents are waiting for a crest of as high as 49.5 feet later today. Extra National Guard troops are hoping to reinforce the levee, protecting the town. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Minnelli reporting.
The government says the number of people filing first-time claims for jobless benefits dropped in the latest reporting period by 60,000. The Labor Department says new claims in the week ending July 31st came to 336,000. In previous weeks, the effects of Midwest flooding and layoffs in the automobile industry had pushed new claims close to 400,000. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Wole Soyinka's writing won him a Nobel Prize for Literature in 1986. Nearly 20 years before that, his criticisms of his government got him about 2 years in solitary confinement. He wrote about his imprisonment in his book The Man Died. His memoir Ake is about the Yorba village he grew up in. He's also the author of many plays and poems. Soyinka was born in 1934 in Nigeria, when it was a colony of England. In the mid-50s, he went to England to study and returned to Nigeria in 1960, the year of its independence. He's in the United States this week. Yesterday, he testified before Congress about the political crisis in his country, where the June elections were annulled by the president. Soyinka is the chair of the African Democratic League. I asked him if the Nobel Prize protected him and made it easier to speak out in Nigeria without the fear of being punished.
Well, it certainly gave me some enhanced status vis-a-vis governance. But I have to say that although it restrained governments somewhat, it did not totally diminish one's vulnerability. If anything, it changed the quality of one's vulnerability. For instance, we had a very fascistic regime called, in fact, before this one, we had a civilian regime, which was under Shagari. And that regime became increasingly brutal and fascistic. And I had to flee the country at one stage. I was actually literally bundled onto the plane through the underground channel by the very people who had been sent to eliminate me. It was a very curious business. But that, was, of course, before the Nobel. I narrate it just to say that even before the Nobel, I had a certain level of protection. But, of course, this became more serious after, you know, as time went on.
This time when you were bundled and put on the plane, was that when you went into exile?
Yes, that's when I went into exile.
What did you think made it okay for you to return? When did you return?
Well, I think I returned out of annoyance about 2 months later. I think it was just the notion of me being forced into yet another exile by a regime which I so totally despised. And so I came back, taking extra precautions and so on and so forth.
What year was it?
Let me go back. That's 1983. Mm-hmm. 83. And I came back because I was convinced that the opposition forces were now sufficiently well geared up to operate on such a level that I could participate. And for me, that was okay. Being a sitting duck is what I've never been able to accept. but if things are happening in which one can be a part, then that's no problem at all. You know, one can accept the risks, you know, in those circumstances. And sure enough, the predicted insurrection began, and eventually Buhari came in with his military coup and pushed them out. And of course, turned just, if anything, even more brutal than Shagari's regime.
It must be awfully frustrating to just have one military dictator replaced by another.
It is frustrating. It is frustrating and boring. Boring. And very boring. Because even when they begin well, as Babangida did, it's no question at all that he came on the wave of popular acclaim, Buhari had been so despotic, so brutal, so intolerant. I mean, he'd even pronounced any discussion of return to civilian rule as illegal and unacceptable and punishable. So the papers could not even discuss dates for return to civilian rule. So when Babangida came in, he was accepted. He made beautiful pronouncements about respect for human rights. He also set a date. He set a date for return to civilian rule. He took one or two economic steps which were quite brave and, you know, quite courageous and sensible. And then gradually, like the rest of them, he began to go seriously wrong, became more repressive, and it became evident that he was seeking to perpetuate himself. In other words, there came a stage where there was no difference between the person, his predecessor, who said, don't so much as discuss a return to democratic rule. This one encouraged everybody not only to discuss, but to participate in an elaborate charade, you know, parallel to all this billion-dollar expensive, extravagant scenario for return to civilian rule with local government elections, state elections, House of Assembly, etc., etc. He had actually put in place a parallel scheme for staying permanently in power, a scheme which was constantly undermining the public motions towards democracy. I don't know which one is more disgusting,
yeah.
Buhari's or Babangida's.
My guest is Wole Soyinka, Nobel laureate and chair of the African Democratic League. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Wole Soyinka, the Nobel Prize-winning writer and also the chairman of the African Democratic League. When you were growing up in Nigeria, your father was headmaster for a school that was set up by the British colonial government.
Missionaries, as a matter of fact.
The missionaries?
Yes.
Were there conflicts in your family between Western-style education and Yoruba tradition?
Not really, because even though, on the one hand, the attitude of my parents, especially my mother, they were Christians and very devout Christians, and my mother was a particularly devout Christian. In fact, I nicknamed her the Wild Christian. And so she tended to look down on what she called pagan practices, pagan religions, and so on and so forth. But my father was he had a more eclectic mind, but was very argumentative and was curious. He had great intellectual curiosity and would want to talk about these things which were called pagan and unchristian anyway. He didn't sort of distance himself from them or pull up the hem of his trousers in that sense.
You wrote in your book about growing up that your mother was often worried about your inwardness. Was that because you read a lot?
Yes, I read a lot, and I rather liked my own company a lot more than is considered healthy in Yoruba traditional society. A child is not supposed to wander off into the woods and stay by himself in, you know, in groves and so on, unless, of course, he was a what we call abami, or abamiyomo.
What does that mean?
Which this means that the child might possibly have companions in the other world. It's a theme which has appeared in some poems of mine and which has been beautifully elaborated in the work of this young writer, Ben Okri, The Famished Road. You know, Yoruba believe in different levels of existence, the world of the living, the world of the ancestor, and the world of the unborn. And a certain kind of child is supposed to continue to retain his or her links with the world of the unborn, those waiting to be born. So when a family, traditional family, sees a child who seems to be a little bit introverted or, you know, solitary in conduct, efforts are made really to pull him out of that, shake him up and throw him among siblings of a different temperament, to bring him back, to bring him down to earth, that sort of thing.
Now, you studied in England. You went to college in England.
Yes.
And I wonder how you felt going to study at the headquarters of the colonial powers.
No qualms at all. I couldn't wait to get away from home into the big, wide world, wherever it happened to be. In fact, at one time I was more interested in coming to the United States. I knew there were more blacks here. It's from all reports from those who'd studied there, the United States had a kind of exotic attraction which the United Kingdom didn't have. The United Kingdom was, you know, a matter of course. Former colonial master, people went there as a matter of course. In the case of the States, it was something of the forbidden fruit there. And that's really where I wanted to come. But England was just as good, since it was outside Nigeria. And I was excited, and I think I lived a very noisy existence as a student there. I was very exploratory.
How much of Yoruba tradition do you feel that you've kept in your life?
Oh, lots, lots. And I think it's... critics acknowledge that it my works are permeated through and through with... many aspects of Yoruba culture, and my lifestyle at home especially is a constant mixture of both the of Western culture and Yoruba culture.
And you're comfortable with a mixture? You don't feel you have to be one thing or the other?
Oh, very, very comfortable. I like comfortable European shoes, and I like Yoruba dansike or whatever it's called in this country. And I like I like going to the wandering through markets and going through the bush and hunting with my fellow Yoruba hunters. And I feel absolutely comfortable. You know, no contradiction internally at all.
And you're comfortable, too, with the combination in your life of being a writer and, you know, often writing fiction and your role as a political activist.
Now, that one, I'm not very sure I always feel comfortable with. There are many, many times, as now, that I feel very highly resentful. I feel a crisis has been imposed on me and others, which is avoidable, which is unnecessary, which is totally disrupted, for instance, you know, to be mundane and specific, disrupted my plans for this year, my creative plans for this year. A crisis which has been born out of the egomania of a bunch of power-drunk people, you know, who should just get out of the way. No, I don't always feel comfortable. Accept it, but resentment is the larger part of my feeling.
What would you like to see the United States do in relationship to the crisis in your country now?
Yes, I'd like to see embargoes inflicted on the country. You know, I'd like to see the revenue from petroleum products, which is our main product, put into an escrow account. I'd like to see an arms embargo, spare parts being withheld. I'd like to see the United States and other outside countries take a very positive step in isolating Nigeria in every possible way, as long as this military junta clings to power.
Will you be in danger when you go back to Nigeria?
Oh, it's always an occupational risk.
So you might be?
Yes, I expect so. It'll govern, that recognition will govern my movements. I mean, I'm not foolhardy, I'm very practical.
And what does that mean? You know where not to go?
Or? I know where not to go. I know when to go in. I know, you know, it's kind of complex kind of existence, but one has to be hard-headed. For instance, the president-elect, Moshood Abiola, was forced to flee the country only yesterday. He's on his way to the States right now. We'd always known that his life was in danger and strongly recommended a series of security precautions and so on and so forth. But he'd stayed very valiantly right in the middle of everything. But two nights ago, he found that he was compelled to leave, at least for a short while.
Is there violence against dissidents now in Nigeria? Are many dissidents being imprisoned?
Yes. We have several pro-democracy activists in detention. The president of the Association for Nigerian Authors, Ken Saro-Wiwa, is in prison and probably be charged also for treason under a newly made decree, a newly passed decree, which virtually makes thinking visibly an act of treason if it can be proved that your process of thought inclined in a particular direction. It's one of the most sweeping and most outrageous decrees ever passed. The government made up its mind a long time ago that it was going to extend its stay indefinitely and began a systematic repression, not only of dissident voices, but of potential dissident voices. So we're really living in perilous times. There's no question at all about that.
Well, I wish you very good luck.
Thank you very much.
Wole Soyinka is a Nobel laureate and chair of the African Democratic League. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what will you have on the budget?
Hi, Terry. Eric Weiner will report on small business reaction to the budget plan being settled in Washington this week. I'll talk with a truck driver waiting for a load out in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He is dissatisfied with the increase in the gasoline tax at 4.3 cents a gallon more. He will pay $800 a year extra, and it's coming right out of his pocket. Other stories, Deborah Amos reports from Sarajevo on the increasingly difficult situation there. Letters from listeners, and Linda Wertheimer has a conversation about Junior Kroll, a character in a children's book. Junior Kroll looks like he's got a cereal bowl upside down on his head.
Thanks, Noah. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. From 1963 to 1967, David Jansen kept one step ahead of the law as he searched for the one-armed man who killed his wife. The TV series was called The Fugitive, and it was an enormous hit. Now it's a movie directed by Andrew Davis, who made Under Siege and Above the Law. Film critic Stephen Schiff is in hot pursuit.
If there's one lesson that thriller makers might draw from this summer, it's this. Keep it simple. That's part of what made Hollywood's best summer movie, In the Line of Fire, work so well. The simple architecture of good guy chasing bad guy was spacious enough to accommodate character and romance and poignancy without interfering with the chugging of the plot. The same goes for The Fugitive, which is essentially about a good guy cop chasing a good guy criminal who himself is chasing the real bad guy. Harrison Ford plays Dr. Richard Kimball, a Chicago vascular surgeon who one evening comes home to find his wife being murdered by a creep with one arm. The creep gets away, and Kimball, in a state of shock, gets hauled in for questioning. It's a scene you've seen a million times before, the hero gradually realizing that he's a suspect, but Ford plays it with such conviction that the chill feels brand new.
Helen comes from a wealthy family. Yes.
Is she insured?
Yes, she is.
Who's the beneficiary? The sole beneficiary?
Yes. Financially, you're not going to be hurting after this, then, are you? I mean, she was worth quite a bit of money. Are you suggesting that I killed my wife? You saying that I crushed her skull and that I shot her? How dare you? When I came home, there was a man in my house. I fought with this man.
Whatever.
He had a mechanical arm.
Plastic.
You find this man. You find this man.
Actually, that's about as much acting as Ford gets to do in this movie. The rest of the time, he's mainly on the run, looking desperate and haggard, and a lot dumber than the movie keeps telling us he is. Most of the performing skill on display belongs to Tommy Lee Jones, as the U.S. Marshal obsessed with bringing Kimball in. It's a tricky role. Jones has to make the Marshal seem frighteningly implacable and at the same time human and virtuous, and he pulls it off by filtering every line through several layers of irony and self-awareness. He brings the audience inside the performance as Ford never manages to do. Still, this isn't an actor's movie. The director, Andrew Davis, has by now made the only good Chuck Norris movie, Code of Silence, and the only good Steven Seagal movie, Under Siege. He's one of the best action directors out there. And in this, his first real A picture, he demonstrates why. The plot of The Fugitive is strung across a series of enormous action set pieces, train wrecks, death-defying leaps, rooftop chases. And except for a climax that's too long and drawn out, the thrills really thrill. Davis's storytelling style is jumpy and elliptical. He trusts the audience to be smart enough to fill in the gaps, which A, makes us feel terrific, and B, gives Davis room to fool us now and then. This movie's full of red herrings, and most of them are a lot of fun. The Fugitive isn't as touching or finally as satisfying as In the Line of Fire, but let's not get greedy. When a movie can make you take old Richard Kimball and his endless search for the one-armed man seriously again in 1993, well, isn't that accomplishment enough?
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Meeting the deadlines here at Fresh Air can be nerve-wracking. We've been lucky to have Sue Weinstein as one of our tape editors. She faces down deadlines with cool nonchalance and has a mind as sharp as the razor she edits tape with. Well, she's just accepted a job teaching in Bolivia. Sure, we're excited for her, but things here won't be quite the same without her. And Sue, is it just coincidence that the same year the gang at Beverly Hills 90210 graduated from high school, you became an alumna of Fresh Air? Well, good luck in Bolivia, and make sure you keep that tattoo covered. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, and Roberta Shurrock, with Sue Weinstein, Nancy Greenlease, and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Broadway is celebrating its 100th birthday this year. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from composer Stephen Sondheim, Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the books for Gypsy and West Side Story, and the late choreographer Michael Bennett, who created A Chorus Line. It's our weekly program featuring interviews from the archives. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.